Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. We are going down a road that I'm very excited about. We are doing some ancient history today. So we have with us Carla Enescu, who is a PhD ancient historian. She's a speaker, lecturer, explorer and traveller, and she's on the road to uncover the long lost mystery that is Artemis. So welcome, Carla.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We are so excited. We're going to be doing all about Artemis, and you're going to tell us why she is the most awesome thing to ever walk this earth, right?
Yes, yes, I am. Yes, I am. Be prepared to be wowed.
That is fine. We are ready to rock and roll. So what you've done, you've sent us a couple of points, and yes. We're going to go through these points. Feel free to talk as much as you like. And we're going to start with the first one. So that's the building of the Artemision and its role as a sanctuary.
Yes. Okay. So that's a perfect start, actually, because the temple is where it all happened, you know? And so where to begin? This temple was built three times. So by the third time, it was the greatest, one of the greatest wonders in the ancient world. So it took three tries to get it right. But this also means that it was very, very, very old. So we are looking easily at like 6th, 7th century BCE. And so it was very, very, very old. And it was in an interesting location in Ephesus, actually. The way that they found the location to put this temple there for Artemis was by following bees.
Bees.
So bees are a bit of my obsession. When we talk about her statue, Artemis has this like this vest on her body, and academics, especially those who are looking into Artemis Ephesia, which is really only like three of us or so in the world, but anyways, we love to argue about what is on this jacket. Okay, so the top two contenders for these bulbous pieces on her jacket is that they are either bull scrotum or beehives.
Okay. I don't know what to say.
There used to be, and I don't, now it's kind of losing popularity, but there used to also be a theory that they were breasts. Okay. The problem with the breast theory, though, is that on the actual statue, and there's only like three originals left in the world, but even the copies later on, there are no nipples.
So they're just like round, circular, non-nipply things.
This is getting a little more rated R than I suspected.
Listen, yes. We love smut, we love sex, don't worry about it. It's not a problem on this podcast. Go as graphic as you like.
So originally, right, like early classicists, when they saw it, they automatically thought breasts. Well, I mean, they were men, so clearly they automatically thought breasts.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And then so they call it this polymastrous jacket. So it's, you know, many boobs on this jacket. But as people started looking at it more and studying more and et cetera, you know, they started thinking, well, this doesn't make any sense because it's clearly a vest. It's clearly no nipples. You know, it's got to be something else. And so then the debate continued. And based on some of her rituals and some of the other animals that are on her vest or on her statue, for example, like there's goats, there's lions, there's numerous other animals, there's lots of bees. And so the two contenders nowadays are, I don't know if they're more exciting, but the bull scrotum and the bees. And the beehives. And so my little obsession started with this, I like bees, but also this digging up of like bee legends and bee symbols and like bee recipes. I mean, they used to make this mead that you could drink, and then they used to make this sort of, well, for less of a better word, this drug that you could smoke out of, you know, honey. And so it became more and more of diving into this the mysteries of bees, you know. So I'm on the bee train. Yeah, some of my colleagues are on the bull scrotum.
I want to know more about these bees.
So let me tell you, okay, so let me tell you a little bit about the bull scrotum. The reason why they think it's bull scrotum, because this is actually quite simple, is because they used to have a festival once a year where they would cut bull scrotum from bulls as a sacrifice and then kind of put them on top of the statue. Okay. So like bloody, if you can imagine bloody bull sacks on her statue. Okay. So this was her, this was sort of a coming of age ritual for young men. And it was, you know, really bloody, clearly a very bloody ritualistic practice. And so this is how some of these scholars believe that this is bull scrotum. Now, I don't know. This is the only thing that really happens that leads to bulls. I mean, the Spartans also worshipped her, and there's a little bit of a bull ritual and a bloody ritual there too. But this is the event that kind of people went, okay, so she must have been covered in bull sacks. That's what the vest is about.
I think that's what every girl aspires to. Is
having, right? Bull sack. It's so literal, right? It's so like, yeah. And so to me, it just doesn't sound right that this goddess that was worshipped for a good 1,000 years, if not more, if we look back pre-Greek, is really enveloped in this vest of this bull scrotum. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's very masculine, let's say. It's a very masculine assumption. I think the bees make the perfect sense because bees are really interesting. They're weird and also very, very interesting. Okay. And the ancients were obsessed with them. And they were obsessed with several things. So let's talk about bees. We'll leave the temple for a minute, but let me talk about bees. Sorry, I'm taking over your bees. Okay, so bees. So when they first established the temple, they followed bees as an omen. And so the idea was that the bees guided their fleet, okay? And then they got there in the port, which was by the waters of Meles. And they saw all these bees sort of swirling around this area. And they were like, okay, this is the place where we're going to build a temple. So that's number one piece of evidence. Okay, bees did that. Then they minted bees on the coins in Ephesus. So one side is a bee, one side is the goddess Artemis. So that's number two. It looks like the bees are important, right? Then after that, the bees are a symbol of parthenogenesis, which I don't know. So parthenogenesis is when a female divinity can create offspring without the help of males. Okay.
That's kind of useful.
So, for example, in Greek mythology, right, Gaia is the first. So out of nothing is Gaia. And she births herself. She births Uranus, which becomes her sun consort kind of thing. And then they birth the rest of the, you know, Greek titans and eventually Olympians and et cetera, et cetera. So this idea that goddesses can birth their own offspring without the help of males is deeply rooted in Greek mythology. Actually, Hera gives birth to Hephaestus alone. So Zeus doesn't help her out of spite because Zeus is having all these affairs and having all these children. So this idea that goddesses could have, or female divinities could have offspring without the help of males, is something that is deeply rooted in bees, because the ancients thought that the bees, like the queen bees, right, were virginal. They didn't see them having been fertilized by any of the male bees, right? And so then they thought of them as these representations of virgin mothers, right? So that was really interesting. And of course, the Greek Artemis is a virginal figure. She's a virginal goddess. And then in Ephesia, she's also, I mean, her virginity is not really that emphasized in Ephesus, but clearly she has no consort and she has no children. So one could argue that she's also a virginal mother in that as well. Right. So these are quite fascinating. I think they really tripped up the ancient philosophers, you know, because they saw them as these mysterious insects, creatures, etc. They also thought that they were prophetic. So they seem to be able to predict the weather, these, which was really interesting, like wind, rain, frost, sun. And then they also, ancient observers also watch them staying close. Like, for example, when something bad was about to happen, bees tend to stay close to their hives, and they would leave. And so they became these prophetic representations, right? So they would watch the bees and be able to see, okay, something bad's going to happen today, or there's going to be a storm, or blah, blah, blah. And so then they had this prophetic imagery, and that was later attached to Delphi, right? To the prophetess in Delphi. So bees are really fascinating in their connections to so much of ancient Greek lore, right? So much of ancient Greek lore. And then we can get into the things that they made from honey or fermented honey, right? So they made the mead, which is kind of like honey, water, and then they added wine. So that was a really good drink, and people had a really good time enjoying their bee beer.
I'd definitely try it. Why not?
So me too. I mean, it's all natural, right? But apparently fermented honey has lots of hallucinogen properties, right? And so it becomes like this intoxicant that they drink, and that sometimes they take, and they have these hallucinogen prophetic dreams. So at the Temple of Delphi, there was a lot of this use of this fermented honey and this bee. In fact, there's this really weird practice that they used to do where they used to make this mead sort of like, it was like a thick, thick fermented honey, but thick enough that you could sort of smoke it so that it had like a smoke coming out of it.
Oh, wow.
And the prophetess at Delphi, okay, used to like, how do I say this? Used to kind of crouch on top of it, kind of like sitting on the toilet, okay? So that the smoke from this fermented honey would enter her body. And in entering through her body, everyone can visualize that, she would be able to prophesize or give a prophecy or whatever. So this is how they initially started prophecy, right? At Delphi anyways. And so it's really interesting that they would use honey, or I guess whatever, smoke honey, or yeah, it sounds kind of weird, right? Because I've never seen smoked honey before, but apparently they would create this sort of smoke from it, and she would crouch on top of it and it would enter her, and then she would be able to give the prophecy. Right?
That's actually really cool.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes when you go down this tunnel, this bee tunnel, you are, some of the stuff that you read, you're just like, wow, it wouldn't even have occurred to me that, you know, anything like that would happen. So, and then of course the idea, the fact that bees reproduce without males, and they produce males or drones, right? So that's sort of spontaneous reproduction, like we talked about, the parthenogenesis. And so they have this, it seems like they have this, literally a hive in which they are the queen bee. And so Artemis sort of becomes the queen bee, in my opinion. You know what I mean? She's sort of seen as the epitome of this virginal mother that feeds the entire world of Ephesus, or the entire city of Ephesus, and of course all her worshipers, virginally. So without giving birth to, let's say, a particular god, but really just nurturing and caring for everybody in the city. So she becomes this kind of bee, virgin, mother, queen, savior, etc. She's a really massive, significant goddess. And I was really surprised when I started my research that more people don't actually really talk about her. You know, scholars talk about Athena a lot. People talk about a lot of Demeter a lot. Of course, Hera every now and then as that nagging wife. But Artemis in Greek history, she kind of gets left behind. She's like, oh yeah, just, you know, that young huntress. She doesn't really like men. She likes to kill people every now and then, you know. She's just prancing around the woods with her little, you know, bow and arrow. And so she almost appears as sort of this adolescent, you know, divinity. And so I think a lot of early classicists just kind of left her as this young woman. But in Ephesus, she is a force to be reckoned with. And for me, what I found more and more is as I traveled, is that I find her in other places throughout the Mediterranean, you know? So of course you find her in Italy, and I found, you know, you find her in like Jerash. I went to Jordan a couple of years ago, and Jerash, they had a huge temple there, a massive temple there to Artemis. And the statue inside the temple of Jerash, of course, is Artemis Ephesia. Interestingly, also Jordanians are big beekeepers. And now we found out that in Israel, actually, as well, there were, you know, hundreds and hundreds of beekeepers, and some of the bees came from Jordan, which may have come from around the Temple of Jerash, which may have been associated with Artemis of Ephesia.
So it all comes down to the bees, basically.
Right. Like, to me, it seems that way. I mean, you know, the argument for the bull scrotum is that ritual, right? So you're like, okay, it was a great ritual. It was probably a lot of fun. Not for the bull, obviously, but you know, I mean, it's not as widespread as some of these other aspects, I think, of the bees. And because Artemis is also the goddess of childbirth, and she is that in both her Greek and her Ephesian incarnation, you know, honey is used commonly for female reproductive complications, right? So you could use honey to induce a girl's first period. You can use honey to assist in labor or soothe the womb after the labor. There are lots of cures that are made using honey for ailments. Like, you know, for example, they have a cure for repositioning a displaced uterus. I mean, that's a serious issue. And they use honey to soothe and ease, you know, moving or, repositioning it. So it seems the more you dig into bees, the more you see how associated they are with the female, sort of the female experience, both in Ephesus and also in the rest of the Mediterranean. And so I think it makes more sense, at least to me, that she would be like the queen bee, you know what I mean? The original queen bee, and that the garment that's wrapped around her body, the tunic, is beehives. And then on the sides of her legs, she also has these like three big bees kind of climbing up her body. So I'm pretty convinced, I'm pretty convinced that, that it's beehives, you know? And we haven't even talked about resurrection, right? Because the bees were thought to be, to resurrect, right? So if, for example, if you've ever been to the, tomb of Agamemnon, and the old sort of Mycenaeans and Minoan tombs, they're all like beehives. Like they're in the shape of cones. And when you go inside, it looks like a beehive.
Oh, wow.
Right? Yeah. And the idea is that they thought that bees had this resurrection, or because they found so many bees, for example, like bee nests in dead bodies, like dead carcasses, there's a sort of symbolic association that out of the dead grows life, you know? Of course, bees just, you know, I mean, they're looking for a location to have a safe nest. And actually, you know, ironically, there's lots of legends of bees nesting in dead bull carcasses. Now imagine if the dead bulls are the ones that lost their scrotums. And then somehow the bees, you know, are coming. So there's this legend that bees grow in carcasses, but the two particular carcasses that they like are bulls and lions, right? So for example, like in the Samson, you know, the story of Samson and Delilah, and Samson, when he finds bees, there's a bee nest inside a lion carcass, right? And he eats the honey and, you know, he causes all these problems. So bees are actually, I think, they're really underrated, historically speaking. I don't know if it's because they're so associated with femaleness and female life experiences, maybe even a little bit of female empowerment, or if just nobody really thought that they were that interesting anymore in the modern age. Like now people are a little more concerned with them because, you know, we need them to live and to pollinate, but for a long time, they were just whatever. They were, you know, not as interesting. And then when you dig backwards, you could see across the world in numerous societies that they were quite significant as far as religion or spirituality or any of those things. And they were really significant to Artemis of Ephesus. So hopefully all my colleagues who hear this podcast are convinced that it makes more sense that she is wearing beehives around her body rather than bull scrotum or breasts. Although there are places in Italy later, you know, depictions of Artemis Ephesia, like in gardens and things I've seen her, where they built the statue as she is. I have a few pictures of it, but then her, like her vest has nipples, and from the nipples comes water, right? So she's become, she's like the sort of garden fountain, and they've used her jacket and they've made nipples, and from the nipples come water. I don't know what to say to that other than, you know, that's the architect's imagination of what those things are. But you will find, like, if you go around, if you go Rome, if you go north of Rome, you'll find some gardens where she will be there in her Ephesian outfit, but they will have given her breasts and made her into some kind of a fountain in which water comes out of these nipples that don't exist in the original statue. Just, you know, people are still obsessed with some of the breasts ideas.
So what's the actual difference between Greek Artemis and the Ephesian version?
So much. The Greek Artemis, like I said, she is basically an adolescent, you know? I mean, you know, we don't have her exact age, but she's very, she often referred to as young virginal. She hangs around with a lot of young nymphs. She doesn't allow anyone to look at her. She punishes Agamemnon by asking for Iphigenia when Agamemnon's heading towards the war, towards the Trojans. And then she saves Iphigenia. So she's a protectress of women in Greek, in the Greek pantheon, and in charge of childbirth. So those are sort of her two responsibilities. Where in Ephesus, because she inherits the history of the Anatolian Kybele, and Kybele is actually multi-breasted, which kind of fights against my theory just a little bit. But so the Kybele, the Anatolian Kybele, the mother goddess, or the goddess of the earth, the goddess, the mistress of animals, she has numerous names. She is depicted sometimes as multi-breasted. And so when the Greeks arrive in Ephesus, because Kybele was also the mistress of animals, they say, well, we have a mistress of animals too. Oh, it's Artemis. And so they sort of transition that worship. But interestingly, in Ephesus, Artemis retains pretty much all of Kybele's responsibilities and powers. And Kybele is like, it is a massive influence. So not only was she, you know, the goddess of the Amazons and a powerful mother divinity, a resurrector of life, a mistress of forests. I mean, Kybele was pretty much the queen bee in, you know, much of this area in the Mediterranean. And so Artemis inherits all of that. And so that's why she becomes Artemis Ephesia. Because then even her representation changes. In the Greek Artemis, she's just wearing like a little dress, a short dress, and she has this bow and arrow. But in the Ephesian representation, she is truly an embodiment of nature. You know, her body is, she has a crown that she wears, right? Which is sort of the city on her head. So again, that comes out of that old tradition. She's the protectress of the city, et cetera, et cetera. But it's also attaching her to royalty. So the idea is that she's a monarch, a divine monarch. And so she's significantly more influential and more powerful in Ephesus. And then for some reason, that representation is really adored by everyone who comes into Ephesus or travels through Ephesus. And of course, the Ephesians themselves. I mean, the Ephesians themselves hold on to her for so long. You know, they fight even later on at the turn of the millennia. They fight against Christianity. They kick Paul out of, you know, he goes in front of the temple of the Artemision and he's trying to talk about Jesus. And they're like, get lost. They throw him out. They beat him up. So the Ephesians were very, very attached to this divinity. She has a month-long celebration for her birthday in May, and it's like Christmas. Yeah, so they have this festival, this procession, in the month of May, which is known as Artemis's birthday month. And so the procession is massive. It's supported by, of course, and paid for by the ruler at the time, the state senator, et cetera, et cetera. It goes well into the Roman Empire. The entire month, everybody has the month off. The month ends with the procession, but throughout the month, they have all these celebrations, parties, dances, theater, et cetera. It's massive. People dress up, they put on masks, they dress as the goddess often. They drink all of this fermented mead, et cetera, in her honor. And then at the end of the month, they have this massive procession. And in the procession, there's young girls and young boys dancing, walking, et cetera, her priestesses. And at the very end of the procession, they carry her statue. Okay. So the last statue, because they have a few other statues. They have nymphs. They have other statues that they carry around and celebrate. But at the very end of the procession, the very last statue, the most important, kind of like the Santa Claus parade. I don't know if you've ever seen the Santa Claus parade, but like here, we have a Santa Claus parade every year in November, and all these, reindeers and elves and people walk in the parade. And then at the very end, of course, you have Santa Claus. Well, that really harkens back to all these processions that they used to have in the ancient world. Santa Claus parade arguably is based in a pagan tradition, right? And so Artemis is the same. Her statue comes at the end. It's fully decorated. No scrotum this time, just flowers and things like that. And so she comes at the end, and then they basically walk around town, the city. So there's a map of how they do the procession, and they walk around the city. Everybody throws flowers, etc., and then they return her to the temple, and then sort of the year starts again.
That actually sounds really awesome.
Oh my gosh. And imagine that it's all paid for. So it was the duty of the city ruler to pay for the entire month. So the food is paid, the booze is paid, the entertainment is paid. And so politicians used to like compete with each other and how much they would spend on this festival. Imagine if we had something like that nowadays, where we would, our politicians would pay for us to party for a month,
I'm sorry.
That they would come.
I mean, when are we doing this idea? This sounds really good fun.
Right. I mean, I think we need to bring back this tradition, right? I mean, it's got to happen again.
That's going to be the new history hack, petition. Let's bring back the Festival of Artemis so we can party and get drunk for a whole month.
Yes. I mean, I'm down for that. I'm just saying, we could start it anytime. Next May sounds great. It's 2021. It's a new year. It's a good thing, right?
Fresh start.
So it was very much like Christmas. And so Ephesians, like they not just worship this goddess, they identified with her. They told their children stories of Artemis, sort of the hero, right? And so she really gave them their identity. And so you could really see that later on when Christianity comes into Ephesus and they fight so hard, to keep her. And I mean, the best they have, of course, becomes, the Virgin Mary. And so they kind of take that for themselves. I don't know if you ever heard, but like the Virgin Mary is named Theotokos, which is Mother of God in Ephesus. And so in my dissertation, when I first started doing this, I argued that it could only happen in Ephesus that Mary could be called Mother of God, because the Ephesians needed a female incarnation of what they had worshipped for so long that they fought to make the only female available in Christianity into almost a goddess. So there was a lot of debate in the early church over the Virgin Mary. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the Ephesians would not give up having some kind of female representative. They were like, okay, I would get you taking us over, but we need something. So let's look at Mary. And in many ways, Artemisia survives. I don't know if I would say survives, but some of her aspects perhaps survive through the, you know, through Mary, because the Ephesians just could not. They just could not find an identity that was not around goddesses. So even today, when you go to Ephesus, you have two goddesses. Well, I mean, to me, goddesses. You have Artemis, you can go to her temple in Ephesus, and then you have the Virgin Mary's house, where she is said to have passed away, where you can go there. So even today, Ephesus is still known for that sort of female divinity, that female energy. You know, it's quite fascinating because it's 2,000 years later.
So what's the similarity between the two?
Between Artemis Ephesia and the Virgin Mary?
Yeah.
I mean, some of the similarity, I mean, the Virgin Mary was very, there are boundaries or limits around her imagery. But some of the interesting things actually that they say about the Virgin Mary, besides the fact that they name her Theotokos, which is the mother of God, which then puts her in this contention. Is she a divine being? Is she not a divine being, et cetera? But one of the things that's interesting about her is this idea of milk and honey, that she provides milk and honey for, obviously for Jesus, but also for her followers. So honey actually continues to remain a big part of early Christian practice. And bees, again, continue to remain this mystery for early Christian. And actually, the Virgin Mary is often associated with bees, or with the queen bee, again, because this idea of this virginity and this parthenogenesis. So the idea that she birthed Jesus technically without the help of a male, a human male, let's say, or organic male matter.
It all comes back down to these bees, right?
Yes, right? Like, it harkens back to this idea of this virgin mother, right? So queen bees technically are virgin mothers because they create males without the help of males, right? That's really fascinating, not just for scholars, but for, you know, numerous religious people or groups or communities. And so the Virgin Mary becomes this sort of iconic bee as well. And so, for example, in the, you know, the medieval period and in the later periods, you can find the association between the Virgin Mary and bees, right? And the sacred honey and things like that. So I think in a way, Mary kept some of that and this idea of mothering, and this idea of virginity, and the sort of part of the royal family. Those are kind of the characteristics. I mean, she's not really as associated with nature or things like that. But actually, interestingly, at Easter in Rome, they have a procession, right? A huge procession at Easter. Huge, huge, huge. Okay. And for many years, I haven't seen it in the last couple of years. But for many years, the last statue, okay, the last statue in the procession is Mary. So Jesus is second last, and Mary is the last. And so other non-Catholics, for example, have argued that this, you know, Catholics are pagans, right? You've heard this argument. Oh my God, they worship Mary, blah, blah, blah. And in part, that is because the very last statue often at the Easter procession is Mary. And traditionally, the last statue is the most important. Yeah. And so if you, like, you can Google or look at old documentaries of the Easter procession in Rome, and you will see all of these non-Catholics kind of lined up yelling, you know, at the procession. Calling, you know, Catholics, you pagans, because Jesus is technically supposed to be last. Although, I mean, technically, the whole procession is a pagan ritual, right? I mean, it's old as time. But the last statue should be the most important statue, and the last statue is always Mary. And I think that that ties in very deeply with the old roots of goddesses birthing their own sons. So Gaia births Uranus. Other goddesses birth, you know, Hera births Hephaestus, Mary births Jesus, Buddha's mom, for example, not to jump into Buddhism, but Buddha's mom, for example, births Buddha without the help of a male. There's this, you know, this idea that female divinities can birth, and there's a sort of magic in creating life without the help of, you know, male organic matter or whatever. And so that's quite a mystery that I think as a species we really like, you know, so we see it repetitive over and over and over and over again. We like this idea, this sort of magical birthing. And so Mary has a lot of that. And so she gets that authority. And in Ephesus, they were really, really interested in having sort of a legend of Mary, since they had to give up, you know, Artemis Ephesia. And so they had to give up the temple. The temple was destroyed by the Goths during the Roman Empire. It was destroyed. Actually, it was destroyed in the summer, just a little while ago, during the birth of Alexander the Great. Sorry, that was the second time that it was destroyed. And then the Goths destroyed it in 276. So they really, actually today, if you go to Ephesus, the only thing that you can really see is literally one pole. Like they only have one pole left of the entire temple. And the temple was massive, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. But that's all that survives now. And then if you go just a little bit more north, you can visit the House of Mary, where she's said to have died. Ephesus is a fascinating place. Fascinating.
I want you to sum up really quickly why Artemis is the most awesome person ever.
So one of my favorite things about her is that she connects the pre-Greek traditions. So all of the Kybele, all of the early Amazon legends, all of these early natural divinities, she connects that through Greek culture and Greek mythos. And so she kind of takes on a little bit of that Greek tradition. She then later also takes on some of the Roman, like the Romans really loved the temple, rebuilt her statues. So she takes on a little bit more of that queen, mother of nature. And lastly, and eventually, she ends up sort of being absorbed or fused with the Virgin Mary, which is arguably the greatest female representation in Christianity. And so I would say that Artemis Ephesia is probably one of the most long-lasting survivor divinity of all time. I think the only other person that I would, the only other divinity that I would argue is equal to her would be Hecate, which is probably another podcast. But yeah, I think that she survives all of these changes, all of these transformations, all of these fusions, and continues to fascinate us today. And that's it.
That's amazing. Thank you very much. Listen, thank you so much for joining us anyway. That was an absolutely brilliant overview. Actually, very detailed overview of Artemis and why she is probably the most amazing goddess out there. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. So much.
Join us tomorrow when Simon Sebag Montefiore will be with us. He's got two new books coming out, and one is a compilation of the greatest speeches in history, and another is a compilation of the greatest letters in history. And we had a great time talking to him about some of his favourites, so don't miss that.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.